Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Monica Alley, whose latest novel is Alentejo Blue, first novel, Brick Lane. Your first novel concerns a Bangladeshi woman coming to England and relates to your own background. The second novel, on the other hand, is something completely different. It occurred to me when reading it, and you just confirmed it off the air, you spend a lot of time in the Alentejo area of Portugal. How'd you discover it?
Well, we've got friends who've lived out there for a long time.
You and your husband.
That's right. And we've been visiting them over the years. Fell in love with the place. Bought a little tumble-down cottage that had no electricity and no running water. We've been doing it up over the years. And I spend about 3 or 4 months of the year there. And Alentejo Blue wasn't the book that I had planned to write next. But what I found was that I was so fascinated with the life of this village that even when I was back at my desk in London, I just kept getting drawn back there. And in the end, I couldn't resist writing about it.
What was the book that you were supposed to be writing?
Well, that's the book that I'm writing now, which is set in England, completely different again. Although I guess when I finish it, I'll probably stand back from it in the way that I've stood back from Alentejo Blue, which I thought was an entirely different book with no similarities at all. And now I've stood back from it, I can see the way in which it's also quite a similar book.
Where is Alentejo?
It is the largest region in Portugal, although it's very little known. It sits directly above the Algarve, which is where most tourists go to. The Algarve runs along the southern coast, and Alentejo runs from the west coast right over to the Spanish border and up towards Lisbon, towards the capital. And in the north part of the Alentejo, it's divided into two, the Alto Alentejo. There's a few marble towns, lots of wheat fields, a couple of vineyards, and not much else. And in the Baixo, the lower Alentejo, where we know best, there's a lot of cork oak trees, and Portugal's the largest exporter of natural cork in the world, as I'm sure you know, and beautiful, unspoilt coastline, and not much else, because the tourists haven't really arrived, you know, in any numbers yet.
You said that the area drew you back, meaning that somewhere in your mind you suddenly found yourself feeling the need to write about it. At what point did you decide, okay, I'm going to create this imaginary town of Mamarosa?
Yeah, Mamarosa is fictional. I think there's a Mamarosa in the north of Portugal somewhere. Well, you know, what I felt drawn to was a number of things. But one thing that I was thinking about was that the place where we spend time, the village, is a kind of pretty little whitewashed, sun-baked village that a lot of Brits and probably a lot of city dwellers in general dream of escaping to. Judging by the popularity of the literature, for instance, A Year in Provence, Under a Tuscan Sun. I think they were big hits, you know, both sides of the Atlantic. But what I wanted to do, paradoxically through fiction, was to inject a little bit more realism, because I think that the literature, non-fiction, tends to be a little bit romanticised, full of quaint and rustic tales of, you know, the wild boar getting into the vegetable patch, which is fun and enjoyable, and I enjoy it too. But I think there are deeper and more interesting things to think about. I can give you a couple of examples of that,
sure,
if you like. So at the opening of the book, there is a story of an old man, a local, who's dealing with the suicide of a close friend and who has lived through some of the worst oppressions of the Salazar regime, the fascist dictatorship. And what I wanted to do through his story was to provide a little bit of context or perspective on the way in which newcomers can arrive and project their own fantasies onto the place as if the place itself bears no weight of history, as though it's a blank canvas, which can never be the case, of course.
Here we have a series of essentially interrelated short stories. Mm-hmm. Some characters appear in the other person's story because it's a small town, but these are interrelated short stories. Did you start at the beginning then, or in the middle and work outward? How did that work?
If I could wave a magic wand, I would want people to begin at the beginning and end at the end. I think there's an overall shape to the book. But you've put your finger on something, obviously, because how I started out, what I thought I would do early on in the writing process, was to take Stanton, the English expatriate writer, as my protagonist and see everything from his perspective. And that would give me a very easy, or at least a very conventional, narrative structure. I quite quickly realised that this was a cop-out, that I was being a bit of a wimp, because he was not my main impetus for writing the book. The place itself was the main impetus. Or, to turn that around, the place itself is the main character. Now, in order to give voice to a place, one has to develop a choral range, as it were, so to inhabit a number of different perspectives. And once I realised that that was my challenge, then I really relished the writing process, you know, to get into the mind of a young boy or an old man, or a local or an expatriate, you know, and then I enjoyed flexing some writing muscles, I guess.
And you were able to use all the techniques, first person, third person, single point of view, third person, multiple point
right.
of view.
Right. You know, that was dictated really by the subject matter, what I had to do. But I think there's also some senses in which my writing matured through the process from first book to second book. To give you an example, I think that perhaps I had more ability to let the silences speak for themselves and write in a slightly less hyperactive way. I suppose, you know, the differently voiced chapters gives an impression of fevered writing activity, but I think actually in a way I was a little bit more bold and just allowing the silences to be.
Monica Alley, you began working on this book before Brick Lane was published?
No, it was after Brick Lane was
published. So you knew that you were in that scary position of writers like Harper Lee, where you're suddenly expected and you know you're going to fail. I mean, there is that thing, right?
Well, I suppose I'd been through some of this question of the weight of expectation with Brick Lane itself, because I sold the book on the first five or six chapters. There was an auction in the States. It was sold into a number of different translations. And while all that was going on, I stopped writing for a couple of months. And I was really quite worried about how it was going to be when I got back to my desk. Would I feel the people looking over my shoulder and so on? But what happened then was that I'd closed the door and I was entirely obsessed with the world that I was creating on the page and not, I didn't care about the publishing world. And so that took me through the writing of Brick Lane. And similarly, I seemed to spend forever on the road doing publicity for Brick Lane. And I had exactly the same thought in my mind. You know, will I just be so fearful that I won't be able to write anything? But, you know, luckily, I was so taken up with what I was doing in terms of the writing that everything else just falls away, you know.
I guess on some level it's easy because you tackled something that on the surface at least looks so different.
Yeah, you know, there's an old saying in writing that you don't choose your material, the material chooses you. So that's what happened this time around. Now that I have just had a bit of time to reflect on what I was doing in Alentejo Blue, I can see that, although, I mean, it's very different in ways that are hardly worth commenting on, and my interests, they remain the same. Brick Lane was essentially a novel of displacement, and those ideas of social dislocation and isolation remain in Alentejo Blue. I seem to be interested in villages. Because Brick Lane is an urban village, you know, it's a village transposed to an urban setting. And I like this idea of taking a place that seems familiar and making it new in some way. So London, we all feel that we know, but this is a slice of London and Brick Lane seen through a new perspective, through a new set of eyes. And the village in the Alentejo, kind of village that we all feel that we know from our travels from passing through. But again, I wanted to unpack that and uncover that and make it new.
When you were creating Alentejo Blue, did the characters come to you, or did you kind of look and say, okay, who am I going to invent next?
I had a wealth of material, really, from observing the life of the village. I think a number of images that I had very strongly in my head were part of the driving impetus to write. So I had an image of an old man in a black felt fedora raising his hand. He had a cut on his hand. And that was really an image of one of my neighbours who's this old guy. He's 78 years old. He lives in this one-room shack. It's really not much more than that. It has no drinking water, no electricity. It's a very basic existence in terms of material goods. He works every day on the land. It's not his land. It's somebody else's. So it's really a kind of a harsh life in lots of ways. And yet, very close by, people would have broadband infrastructure and their cell phones and so on. There's, you know, EU money, European Union money coming in for these brand new roads, which suddenly tail off into these dirt tracks. So that kind of butting up of wealth and poverty, and the, you know, the globalised world that we live in, people coming and going, passing through, and pockets of poverty, that was one of the things that I wanted to write about. But characters, yes, I had characters galore, really, to choose from.
It struck me that one character, a fat cafe owner named Vasco, as time went on, he seemed to take more of a role in the book, and I'm just wondering if that was planned, or was it just that his history was so different from the others and you just kind of got caught up in it?
Yeah, there's always an issue about, you know, how much do you control your characters and how much do they control you? Writers have different perspectives. And Harold Pinter, in his Nobel acceptance speech, recently said that he was talking about his writing process, and he said that you don't control the characters, they resist the author, you know, they make his life difficult. Nabokov very famously said that his characters are galley slaves, you know, that he's totally in control. I'm somewhere between those two, and that's a fascinating part of writing for me, this question of agency or otherwise. You know, I think that's what always grappling with when you're writing. You give the character a family background, a setting, you create coincidence and chance, and the question is, how do they respond? How free are they? Which is a question in their lives and our lives, and it's a question for the writer as well.
The ending of the book brings them all together, a clash of people who are now fully formed. So at that point, you kind of need to let them speak for themselves, I would think.
Yeah. The characters always have ways of taking you in new directions. You know, it's always a give and take with the character and the writer for me. And they come together at the end. I mean, partly what I'm interested in that section is this person who is the prodigal son of the village, character Marco. And I'm having a bit of fun with him because that's a very traditional sort of role for him to inhabit. What I was exploring there was the way in which he is a reflecting wall. So the characters look at him and they see their own hopes and fears reflecting back at them. So in that final chapter, that's really about letting them free to see what it is that they see in him, because they're really seeing themselves.
The New York Times review said that there's a character named Eileen who's almost the voice of Monica Alley. She's a tourist traveling through. I didn't feel that.
I think that me and Eileen are poles apart as much as, as much really as me and Nazneen, the heroine of Brick Lane, are poles apart. You know, Nazneen grows up in a small village in Bangladesh. She's illiterate. I mean, she's a very interesting person to me. She's intelligent. She has a sense of humor, but she has a very narrow world view given by her background. I just think it's plain stupid to think that a writer has to be exactly the same as the character that they're creating. I mean, that is literature's gift. It's its contribution to try and stand in another person's shoes, or at least to smell the shoe leather. You know, that is the point of fiction for me, the moral heart of fiction. That is it for me.
Have you learned, at least now, to step back and reading these reviews and people telling you who you are or what you're doing and realize there's no connection?
I mean, it's amusing. My brother, I haven't read a lot of the reviews in London, but people tell me what's in them. And me and my brother were laughing the other day because he told me about a review which said, really, she should stick to writing about what she knows, which is Brick Lane. And he was just in hysterics because he said, well, you've never lived a day in Brick Lane, but you spend all this time in Portugal. People have all these assumptions about you, and really they don't know, they haven't got a clue. I think the wanting to identify the writer with the character, it's an understandable impulse, but it can take you very badly awry, very badly astray. the oddest thing in that New York Times review, which is a review that I did read, was there seemed to be a suggestion that Eileen, the middle-class educator character, was the one really that I had permission to write about. And also that the other characters weren't really capable of an internal narrative, a cohesive or interesting look at themselves, that they didn't have that ability, which I find incredibly bigoted and patronising to most of the world's population. It's also really inconsistent with the way that that reviewer had praised Brick Lane, because, of course, Nazneen, as I just mentioned, is not somebody who is middle class and educated. And of course she has a world view and a point of view and a perspective and an internal narrative. Of course. Otherwise you damn most of humanity. I can't understand that.
You're listening to an interview with Monica Alley, whose latest book is Alentejo Blue. Your first novel was Brick Lane, and let's talk a little about that and about you, Monica. You were born in Bangladesh because your parents met in England, mm-hmm. and then your father, who's Bengali, had to go back. Your mother followed him, and you were born there. Do you have any memories of those early days in what was then East Pakistan?
Well, I think that I have a few fragments of memories, but it's hard for me to tell. I left when I was 3.5. I don't know whether they're inherited memories from listening to stories time and again, particularly of the, you know, the Civil War. What I remember more for myself is the time of coming to England. So of course, the big trauma for my parents was the war situation. But I think for me, arriving in England and not speaking the language and my father suddenly not being there and the big upheaval, I have clearer memories of that, actually.
Did you ever go back?
No, I tried to go back a few years ago and I couldn't get a visa. That's because I put writer down on my application form, which was a mistake. I should have put housewife or something and then it would have been no problem. I've travelled in the subcontinent and most recently I went back to Calcutta again a couple of years ago, which is, of course, West Bengal. So that's the closest I've been. But I hope, you know, at some point where I can go and it would be an entirely private visit, then I would like to do that.
When you began writing, it kind of just suddenly said, okay, my kids are born, I feel the urge to write. At that point, you began writing, and you'd written very little before the book was sold, which must have been very daunting for you to suddenly realize you had a book contract.
It was incredible, really. I started writing when my son was born, my first child, and I wrote a few short stories. I used to go onto the internet late at night, find these short story forums where you'd swap stories and swap critiques, and it's all done anonymously and it's quite vicious, but it was good for getting me into the habit of writing regularly. And then I had a 2-year-old in tow and a 5-month-old baby when I started writing Brick Lane. I was often writing in the middle of the night again. But once I'd started that process of getting Brick Lane down on paper or onto the screen, I knew that I was going to finish it no matter what. You know, I had enough desire to do it that I would have done it no matter what. The contract coming along was a complete surprise. You know, my idea was that I would finish the book, try to find an agent, spend years and years in my lonely garret working unpaid, and maybe if I was really lucky one day somebody might look at it. I had no idea. I mean, I thought writing about a Bangladeshi housewife, and it really is very tight from her perspective. Who's going to want to read about that?
What was your knowledge of Brick Lane? What was your knowledge of that part of London at the time? I mean, you grew up, yes, you had a Bengali dad, but you grew up in a far more English society.
Well, I grew up in the north of England in a town called Bolton, which has actually a very sizable Asian community, or communities more accurately. Not huge amounts of Bangladeshis, mainly Gujarati, Punjabi, Pakistani. But my father had quite a few Bangladeshi friends. You know, there was always a thing of adjusting to two cultures and living between two cultures, behaving one way with my white friends from school and having to alter my behaviour and observances when I was, you know, in the home, a Bangladeshi home, which is very good training. A writer, I think, makes you a keen observer.
It also makes you a little schizophrenic, I would think.
Well, I think lots of writers are forged in a feeling of being an outsider, whether that's, you know, a cultural thing or whether it's an imagined thing or real in another way. In terms of Brick Lane itself, you know, of course, a lot of the time in the book I'm drawing on my own experience It doesn't matter whether that was a little bit farther to the north or whether it was there. I could have set it in Bolton. Why not? It's just that the largest Bangladeshi community in England is in London and Brick Lane. So it made sense. Also, I've lived in London for a long time, so it was easy for me to get there and research. I do my research reading, using all the obvious research resources, spending time on the estates, the housing projects around the back of Brick Lane, interviewing drugs workers, youth workers, community workers, people in women's centres there, just talking to people, just going into places and talking to people. But research for me is that's the easy part, really. If you can travel, if you have access to the internet and you're able to interview people and so on, it ain't that hard. You know, anyone who wants to know that there is overcrowding in Tower Hamlets, this area, can find out pretty damn quickly. It's not a problem.
Okay, you begin this book and you start writing all about Nazneen and her family. When you went into the areas, the project areas, you must have met people almost like her, not the same personality, young women who were married to older men and then found themselves in this alien culture.
Yes. And, you know, in particular, there are some of the housing projects around there. There are women's centres on the projects. So that was a way in for me to talk to people, sometimes through translators, because people can spend 20 years or more living there and not learn the language. There are now women-only English language classes, because that's a problem for the husbands if they're going to a class where there's, you know, it's mixed sex, so that's an issue. Also, in terms of economic independence, some of the women's projects started up small-scale, crafts-based, home-based work that the women could do, but then the question was, how would they keep the money for themselves? That was a big issue, and usually it was addressed by finding ways of hiding it. So, yes, of course, I'm drawing on my research, but, you know, it's not always the obvious sources either for inspiration. I've written about this before. One of the inspirations for Nazneen was my mother. My mother is white. She grew up in England. She went to Dhaka to marry my father. But the experiences that she spoke to me about time and again, of that feeling of utter social dislocation, cultural dislocation, inscribed themselves really deeply on me. So when my heroine, Nazneen, she makes the opposite journey from rural Bangladesh to London to get married, I have three sets of eyes to see through. I have my mother's, my own, and Nazneen's. So it's not always the ways in which you're drawing on real life. It isn't always the obvious ones.
That, in a weird way, since he was supposed to be the protagonist of Voluntario Blue, in a way makes Stanton Nazneen as well, the expatriate coming to live in this strange environment.
Yeah, with a more weary and cynical view.
Well, yeah.
Which, I guess, if there's one character who's slightly unsympathetic in Voluntario Blue, it would be him. And I guess if I'd stuck with him all the way through as a protagonist, that would have abated in some sense, because, you know, there are glimmers of redeeming qualities in him. He knows what he is, and he feels that he's not living his life necessarily in the way that he should. So we only get glimmers of those redeeming qualities because we move away from him again.
When did you start going to Portugal?
Oh, well, the first time I went to Portugal, I guess, was when I was 20. Yeah, and then intermittently since then, and probably over the last 10 years, a lot more.
Then, to that degree, Monica, Ali, your experiences as an alien in the Voluntario, to some degree, on some level, has to influence Nazneen's experiences in London.
right. You see, it all gets mixed up, which is why it's so hard for people to decipher what you are and what you aren't allowed to write about, because life is complicated, which is why it's a great joy to write about. People have many, many entangled influences. You know, I guess I try to see that in my characters as well. You know, they have competing desires as well. Nazneen certainly does, and the characters in Voluntario Blue also. They, you know, Stanton in some ways is fighting his own demons.
Her husband, Chanu, is a kind of infuriating character.
How could you say that? Everybody loves him.
Well,
as long as they don't have to cut his corns, they love him.
When you began writing him, he starts out very unsympathetic and becomes sympathetic. I'm just thinking about that process in terms of, say, the way you were talking about Stanton, because it sounds like a similar process. If you're going to write about somebody and get into them, you have to become sympathetic.
Yeah, you know, when I'm writing about my characters, I think of them as people. I mean, I'm not crazy. I know that they're not real.
Right.
To me, when I'm writing them, they are real. Yes, I try to treat them with, you know, the respect and compassion that I would give to anybody that I encounter. I mean, I hope I'm not a sentimental writer, because I think that sentimentality is the enemy of true emotion. But I feel a kind of love for them when I'm writing about them.
What do you think is the difference between sentimentality then and romanticism?
Well, I suppose you could conflate those two words together, couldn't you? Sentimentality, I guess, is cheapened emotion. You know, it's easy emotion. It's a sort of ersatz emotion, I guess. And it takes the place of true, deep feeling. Now, romanticism, I don't know, people define it in different ways, don't they? On the positive side, that would be a sort of almost heroic aspect to it. If you were to write a truly romantic story, I feel you have to have some sort of heroic qualities in there. But of course, there's sort of cheap romanticism too, isn't there?
You also bring up a point from what you said before, that to some degree, fiction is more real than nonfiction.
Did I say that? Well, I think it's G.K. Chesterton that the difference between fiction and fact is that fiction has to be credible. Sometimes reality is actually more incredible. And in fiction, you have to maintain a credibility. The example that we were talking about earlier, though, I think drives in the opposite direction, that the nonfiction approach in some of the Mediterranean literature, the moving abroad tale and how you manage the builders and, you know, the problems of procuring good builders and so on, that the picture is just simply not wide enough for me. It doesn't take on board some of the more interesting things that are going on. I think that's the difficulty there, for me anyway.
Monica Alley, the sadness of the opening section of Alentejo Blue, this poor man who is in love with this other man who dies, kills himself, set against the background of a terrible, terrible government in Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, it's a democracy and it's free, but I think the romanticism would tend to deny for both Spain and Portugal, I would think, some of the more horrific aspects of what's happened within the lifetimes of many people still living there, most people.
Yes, yes, exactly. I guess I wanted that section to cast a kind of shadow, I don't know if that's the right word, but to give a certain reading to what follows on in the book, to understand that there is this other reality of what has happened there and what is going on there, so that when Eileen, for instance, the English tourist, packs it up in her dreams of, you know, the way that she wants to rebuild her life or to claim it as a kind of a new beginning, a fresh start, a quaint little tranquil, beautiful village, that we understand, you know, that we understand something else that has been going on. And also the ways in which, you know, we never know other people's stories.
Do you think a writer, novelist has any kind of political responsibility, or is it just kind of a social responsibility to try to tell the truth?
I was really thrilled when Brick Lane got shortlisted for a prize, the George Orwell Prize for Political Writing. That was my biggest satisfaction, I think. But having said that, I think that the moral onus on a writer is really to tell the truth about the world as you see it. And if that involves narrating your trip from the bathroom to the bedroom in great detail, then that is what you must do. I don't think that there should be any pressure to do otherwise. For my own satisfaction, I wish more writers would be engaged with broader issues and questions about the way that we live now, the way society is changing, the new challenges it has to face, issues about globalization, for instance. You know, that is my personal point of view, because those are my interests.
When you were working on Brick Lane in particular, how often did the politics of the immigrant experience in London seep in? Did you try to just, like, say, okay, I have my point of view, but I'm going to try to repress it in order to tell the story, in order to be truthful. How did that work?
I write from character. I mean, okay. I always write from character, so it has to come organically from the character. I never want to them just to be a mouthpiece for me. I think, you know, that's easy to go down that road, to, you know, to stick your authorial point of view in there. It's too easy. And it's not as interesting, because the characters allow you to explore all these different attitudes, and they all have something valid, you know.
That, again, brings up a question involving both that and sentimentality. Did you find in writing either of these books that you suddenly pull back and go, this is Monica's political point of view, or this is Monica taking the easy way out and being sentimental, and then you have to rewrite? I mean, did that happen?
You know, I can't start writing until I feel that I know the character well enough. So it's really a sort of process of immersion into the character as best as I can do it. And that's why, you know, I was saying about research as sort of the relatively easy bit. The hard bit, the challenge, is to imagine. You know, that is the task of the fiction writer. So it's only once you've begun that process and you're far enough into it, that for me, that I'm able to write anything at all. The other part of research that's useful, it's for procrastination. You can put things off and you need to hesitate sometimes. So it allows you that time, or it allows me that time before I start getting into words on the page, that I can build those characters, really. So I think that's my answer.
Monica Alley, what are you working on now? You said you started this novel.
Yeah.
Is it another fish out of water novel?
It's set in London and the north of England. It's different again. It's a great pleasure not to have to talk about it. I take every opportunity not to talk about it. I say it's different again. Maybe when I step back from it, I'll see it's the same again. I don't know. I can't see that at the moment. It's what I want to write now.
You talked about yourself as a writer for many years, and you didn't write. And somehow, at one point, after your second child was born, you got the urge to write. What happened? I mean, what was that process like?
You know, I never said I want to be a writer until
really?
I started writing. I never had the idea of being a writer. I was always a great reader, you know, always from childhood.
Right.
Always had my head stuck in a book. My father is a great storyteller. Maybe I got a bit of a storytelling gene from him. But, you know, I never thought it was something that I could do, to be a writer. And even now, I think, what is that thing of being a writer? You know, I want to write. I know what I want to say in my next book through these characters that I've been living with for some time now. I have an idea that I want to write after this book. But this whole sort of thing of persona of a writer kind of fills me with horror. You know, the rest of it is just, I don't know. I don't go around feeling, oh, I am a writer. It's just not part of my psyche, really. I don't know, I just hate the thing of a job description and your writing career and all of that. And you have to, I mean, you know, some interviews are enjoyable like today, but most of them, frankly, I could live without. And, you know, the whole thing of going on to, I don't know this. And then you're supposed to opine on various subjects, which really, why should you be opining on them? You know what I mean? There's a whole package. Or you are now a writer and therefore this, and you have to be this way and talk about these things. And it's just, I probably shouldn't be saying all this. It probably sounds really annoying, but you know, I want to write, and I'm glad if people enjoy my books. You know, that's very important to me, to get feedback from readers, and that is the bonus of being on a book tour like I am now, that you get feedback from readers, which is hugely, hugely gratifying. But no, I mean, why? I don't know. Maybe in 10 years' time I'll do something else. I don't know.
You've been listening to an interview with Monica Alley, whose latest book is Alentejo Blue, the first novel, Brick Lane. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.